Greetings. This is Dr. Mike Barnes. I just wanted to say thanks for joining the Beyond Addiction and Trauma, the Family Recovery Podcast. And today, our episode guest is David Whitesock. He's the founder and CEO of Commonly Well. He's a former radio host and attorney. I first met David several years ago when he was the Chief Innovation Officer at Face It Together. And he I had been aware of the concept of recovery capital, but he really introduced me to a new way of looking at it. And Commonly Well has developed assessment tools for individuals with addiction to be able to measure the resources that they have to be able to work on recovery and maintain recovery, but also a resiliency measure for family members that I thought would be really interesting for the listeners to this podcast. And so these measures look at personal, social, cultural resources that individuals with addiction and their family members can draw on to sustain recovery. So, should be an interesting discussion. So, remember, you can listen to this podcast on Apple Podcasts. You can watch it on my YouTube channel, Michael Barnes, PhD, LAC, LPC. Should be easy to find. And finally, please remember that you can purchase my book, When the Solution Becomes the Problem, Helping Families Struggling with Addiction and Trauma. You can find that on my website, drmikebarnes.com. We have paperback, we have electronic versions. Please take a look. There's also a lot of other videos on my YouTube channel that you might find interesting as well. And so, welcome to the podcast, and let's get started in our conversation with David about recovery capital. Good morning, everyone, and welcome to the podcast. This is the Beyond Addiction and Trauma, the Family Recovery Podcast, and it is for families who are struggling with a loved one's addiction and trauma and the secondary trauma that the family experiences. My guest today is David Whitesock, who I've known for actually quite a while, and we've had a lot of really productive conversations. And I love his work, and I love particularly his work with recovery capital and how to help clients kind of recognize what recovery is and how to measure it and the importance of measuring. And so David is the CEO and the founder of Commonly Well, the company that he can explain far better than I can. So David, why don't you tell our listeners a little bit about you and how you got to be doing this work?
Yeah, I appreciate the invitation and this conversation, Dr. Barnes. So Commonly Well is, in shorthand, a behavioral health analytics company. At the heart of what we do is really try to help treatment providers, behavioral health clinics, recovery support organizations of all sizes get a better handle of the data that they utilize in their practice. And that could be all kinds of data, right?
Sure.
EMR, where you're wearing an Apple Watch, it could be, that kind of data. Or it could be survey data, which is what we primarily specialize in. And to help reorient that information so that those that are providing the care and the participant has a little bit more context of the process they're going through. And at the end of the day, because it's really important to the operation of clinics and providers, is can they measure outcomes? So are people actually getting better relative to the way that we'd like them to get better? That's a hard thing to do, but that's what we do, and we've been doing that now since 2020, but I've been doing this work around measuring recovery since 2011, 2012.
Wow, that's awesome. And talk a little bit about, I mean, you're clearly highly motivated and interested in data collection and being able to show that we are making a difference. So for the listener, why is that so important today in an addiction world that is shifting and changing and why, in my opinion, now more than ever, needs outcome. What's your thought on that?
You know, that the way you phrase that question is the right way is why is it important at all? And what I would first say is there's two layers to it. The first layer is society and psychology. You know this, you've practiced, whether it's a family member or a person in an addiction, there are outside forces telling them, or inside forces reinforcing that they are no good, that they are not worthy, that they are not making progress, that they've been going at this forever and nothing seems to have changed. What data can do, whether it's coming from self-assessments, self-reported surveys, or maybe from a family member kind of assessing their loved one, which is scary, or from other biometric information that we might have. Let's call it sleep data. We know for a fact that anybody who stops drinking for 120 days, their sleep fundamentally changes for the better. Well, what can that tell me? What can that feedback tell me? It can tell me I'm doing better than what my brain says I am, which we know is a lagging motivator because we've lived in the mires of the condition. You can call it disease, condition, whatever, the malady, if we want to go old school, for years, decades. We're trying to untrain that. We're trying to rewire that. So, you know, why has Weight Watchers worked? It worked because every Sunday, a bunch of people would go down to a building and go stand on a scale in front of a bunch of people, and they'd get instant feedback, not just from the scale at their feet, but from the room of people around them in a loving, compassionate kind of way. That's what's really at the heart of this is to help drive that narrative inside people, inside clinics, outside in society, that there is change happening.
You know, sometimes data can feel impersonal, but it's the only real data to make these decisions on. Because I think about how often I ask a family, "So how are you doing? How's your week been?" And so often it's like, "Well, my loved one's doing pretty good right now, so I'm doing pretty good." And that idea of the lens, but let the loved one have one bad day, and suddenly the wheels come off the bus. And that families are kind of looking at their loved one's recovery through the lens of their own secondary trauma and the consequences of a long period of dealing with it. And what I love about this is that it allows people to step back from that lens a little bit to say, I understand the data now. I understand the ups and downs. And you explained that to me once really well about, like, there's a lot of variability in a person's recovery. And it's not straight line. It's up and down. Can you talk a little bit about that for the families to understand? It's not
Yeah.
really that straightforward.
No, not at all. I don't like to use the phrase that relapse happens, but it does. All right. We're going to return to that behavior. It's a cycle of change. And that we can have a whole other separate conversation about that. But when we're actually asking people to measure and provide a self-report on how they are doing, if it's the very first time, you know, I walk into your office, Dr. B, and you're saying we don't know each other really, and you ask me to fill out some forms. I want to do well. I exaggerate. Now, a family member who's been burned and is feeling angry and resentful about all of this, they'll use a different word. He's lying to you. Well, we all do that. Go to a dinner party and go sit around with a group of people that you don't know. Do you not embellish in that first impression who you are? Consciously or unconsciously, we all do it. And so that actually happens in that process. And so what we see are the scores start a little elevated. And then a relationship happens. You start to do the work, they start to actually absorb the work. And we see the scores go down. And it's not because they're doing bad necessarily, it's now that they are actually rigorously evaluating themselves. And then they say, well, yeah, my life really isn't great. And here's what it really is. And then we see the scores go up. And then at about 150 to 180 days, it plateaus and then they go down again. So when somebody's been in that care therapy for 6, 7, 9 months, whatever that looks like, by the time we get to 6 months, now we start to internalize a lot of the other things around us, and things get tricky and scary and life changes. And so we get a dip. But by a year, we start to climb back up to our baseline. What we find is people end up regressing to their own mean, to use a fancy statistical language. But for the family member, people start to find their base of okay. And that's for all of us, every human being walking on the planet. We have to find that stasis, that homeostasis. And we all have that somewhere. It might be different based upon circumstances. If I'm living in addiction, that homeostasis is really, really low. If I've got a great job and just got hired and had a kid and everything, cloud nine, that homeostasis is much higher. And that's what the data and that's what the surveying actually shows us over time, is that okay point kind of goes up and down.
It's interesting from a systems theory perspective that to create homeostasis, you have to have recursive process, meaning as I change, the other people change, and we kind of get to that. And
Yeah.
that's one of the things that I like about this, that it takes out, we're just going to measure the one person changing. And in my opinion, using both the resiliency index and the recovery capital index, to be able to show the recursiveness a little bit, to be able to show the influence that maybe the partner, the parent, whatever's struggle with their own recovery might be having on other people in the family as well.
Yeah, and my previous work was developing and operating a non-clinical peer coaching organization in Colorado and the Dakotas. And we first started out doing that for what we called people with the disease. So folks that came in and identified that they had a substance use problem. But about 4 of 10 people that walked in the door on a daily basis, they were moms and dads and brothers and sisters who were just, they were sick and tired of being sick and tired. And they were like, what do I do? And finally, we had a coach who lived on both sides of that coin. He was himself in recovery, and now he was a father dealing with somebody. And he was he was basically the gentleman that invented the coaching for us. And one day he walked into my office and said, I've got this mom over here, and I think we've got to come up with a coaching program for moms or dads or families. And so that became loved one coaching. And it was that same kind of experience where we said, well, let's forget about this person you want to get better. They're out there doing their thing. Let's just focus on you for a little bit and see what happens.
It's music to my ears,
It
David.
changes. It changes the entire orientation of the nature of the problem.
It really does. So, you and I have talked about this in the past, and I did a group recently where I was talking about the levels of recovery from abstinence to more sobriety that is more focused on I need to change and I need to address my illness, and then recovery is a much broader term, and that there are people out there who say, well, there's no way to measure that, and but to measure it ruins the uniqueness of each individual's quality of life and all of that. Like, how do you view recovery and what we actually measure?
I actually really like the SAMHSA definition. So the Substance Abuse Mental Health Agency in the United States, whether that's still going to be around by the time this comes out or not, who knows? But SAMHSA's definition from about, I don't know, it was 2018, they settled on this idea that recovery is a process of change that is self-directed towards the improvement of a person's life, towards a sense of purpose and well-being. that says nothing about recovery, whatever we think that is in our communities. It says nothing about using or not using drugs. It is a holistic, human-oriented change toward a place of thriving. And so that's the way I like to think of it. We all have something that is either our vice or our disturbance in our life. So just because we're talking about substance use, it's an addiction. Mine was an addiction to alcohol and a couple of other drugs, complicated by depression. All right, so we've got multiple variables there. And there's a lot of different ways that we can engage those things. But when I talk to, when we are developing the Recovery Capital Index, we talk to a lot of primary care physicians. And I'd ask them, how do you define recovery? And one doctor said to me, I know why you're asking me this question because I know what you do. But recovery to a doctor is you walk in with a broken arm. I set the broken arm. We have to let it recover. That's why we put it into a cast. We take the cast off to see if it has returned to its strength. And then you will slowly build from that recovered arm. When we apply that thinking to substance use, now the complication is gone. It literally is just, my life is not great today. Here are a bunch of reasons why it's not. Which ones of these can I fix today? Which ones do I have to have a plan for and work on? Where do I want my life to be? And how do I progress towards that? That's it.
Well, I think if you add the chronic disease model and the idea that if I do those things that make my life what it is, that there's a pretty high likelihood that I'm going to be able to manage the various biological, psychological, social things that drive relapse. And so it does build on both models of illness, if you.
Yeah, I had somebody say to me once, you do realize life is chronic. And, because we work in the space, we tend to zero down into our specialty of thing, the thing that we're changing. But when we really step back and philosophically take the long view, we've got this 60 to 100 years that we're here. Okay. We are terminal. What are we going to do about it? What are we going to do in the interim? Some of us fall into pits of blackness and darkness, and we've got to figure our way out of that. But that's life. Always has been, always will be. It's just how do we navigate around it and through it, within the circumstances that are specific to us.
Yeah, I mean it's interesting. I was thinking when you mentioned SAMHSA, and I always think of the eight wheel of wellness and all of that, that it doesn't actually say addiction as one of the things on there. I mean, it certainly has medical complications, those kinds of things, but it's why I really love the idea that families go into recovery as well, because all of the things in that definition are as consistent for family members who have someone they dearly love and they're terrified that something bad is going to continue to happen. And so it's not just like that one person does it. It is a wellness process for the entire family.
Yeah, I mean, having seen this so many times and having seen it with my own family, we draw a line in the sand, right? I came into your office for some reason, right? I'm in your group for some reason. That's a line in the sand. Okay, now what are we going to do on the other side of that line? And the work that we do through that process, that's recovery. I think a lot of people struggle as families do with that word because they don't feel like one, even worse than the person who's struggling with the issue, doesn't want to wear the scarlet letter A. Don't call me an alcoholic. Don't call me an addict. I don't want to have that hung around my neck. And family members are like, I don't want to have that hung around my neck either, even worse than anybody else. I'm not the one with the problem here. And I think you know this is better than I do, but I think once we get folks beyond that, mind trap of whatever it is, we can release ourselves into, okay, I've been drugged down. It's like, the analogy I use is you're in a pool, but you can't get out, and there's somebody underneath the water keeping you tugged down. Sometimes it's overt, and other times it's psychological. This is us getting out of the pool.
Yeah, it's that parallel process that we were kind of talking about in that. It's really the same process for the person with the addiction and the person who doesn't have it. And once they've kind of gotten past the fact that it's really not, we're all struggling with the same thing. Not necessarily we all have the same illness, but we're all, I love the narrative therapy externalization of the problem, the idea that it's like the addiction may be housed in the body of one person, but the impact of it certainly impacts the entire system.
Yeah, I'm the 12 steps are pretty meaningful in my life, and that first step I've meditated and worked on a lot. I have trouble sometimes with the wording of the first step. I don't like being called powerless. That's a because you're trying to find your power. But what's key to that first step is recognizing that something wasn't right. Something I couldn't manage. It's a dichotomy of language in that first step, because we're both saying, I recognize something was unmanageable and I was powerless. Okay, so what are we trying to do? We're really trying to take back some amount of control. The control that we can actually have, right? In the Serenity Prayer, if you will. Now, I know this isn't a 12-step podcast, but a lot of these things are long tried true human truisms, Stoicism. Marcus Aurelius really is kind of the origins of what can I control, what can't I control? And if I know the difference, I'm going to have a better day today than I did yesterday. Well, that applies to the struggling person with addiction, to the family member who's watching it from the outside, going, what do I do about this?
Yeah, it's I think it's just such an important part of it. So the term recovery capital was coined in 1999, I think. Cloud and Granfield, we've talked about their book a little bit. How has the field of study of compassion or compassion fatigue, that's mine, my stuff, the of recovery capital, how's it changed since the early days?
Yeah, the original concept was kind of wrapped up in this idea that there were really kind of two paths to getting well. There was the 12-step path, and then there was a therapeutic path. And eventually, those two things kind of merged into 12-step facilitated treatment.
Sure.
What Cloud and Granfield were doing, where it was looking at and saying, well, isn't there a third way? It's kind of very Buddhist, isn't there a third road? Isn't there a way that's inside me or inside the community that if I just pull the right levers or have the right assets assigned to me or I tap into, can I use that to get better? And that's what they were kind of looking at. And that was sort of the origin of really very holistic kind of thinking. What's changed over time is actually the introduction of this idea of social determinants of health and thinking of it more from a clinical practice, chronic disease management approach of treating the whole person and recognizing that, yeah, you have a mental health condition and I'm going to help you with that anxiety disorder and that substance use problem. But the effect on my ability to help you through that is determined a bit by the fact that you can't get to my office because you don't have a car or you lost your license. You can't get a job because you were just convicted of a felony and your profession was healthcare. So you can no longer become a nurse. And now what? Well, your whole world's flipped upside down. Before we used to just set those things aside and say, no, I'm just going to treat you for depression and we'll solve that problem first, and then you get back to your life. What's changed is now we've said, no, we have to kind of do all of this at once, and recovery capital has sort of brought itself into that fullness of conversation.
So probably now's a good time to talk about when you talk about recovery capital, how do you measure it? And what are the categories of life changes or life experiences that you look at to judge or to help people assess their own recovery strengths, resources?
Yeah, so for those that are listening, let's first define it. What is recovery capital? We define that as the internal and external resources that an individual either has directly or that they can access in the outside to help them initiate, maintain, or grow that recovery process, as we defined earlier. So that's that. So we have that definition, then we break that definition down. This is a very logical, rational engineering process to get through this. So how do we break that down? What are those assets? Okay, let's look at social science, and social science has been doing this for over 100 years. Quality of life measures. There are instruments, and Gallup's been doing this forever, measuring various quality of life aspects and happiness in particular. And so you talk to the scientists and they'll tell you, well, there's about 15 to 30 different variables in the world that contribute to the improvement of the human condition. What are those? Well, we can start rattling them off and categorizing them. So let's categorize them. First category is personal capital. These are things like employment, housing, education, food, nutrition, financial well-being. So basic needs. Still got a house, got to work, whatever. It also includes my general health and general mental health. So that's personal capital. These are things really, really close to my day-to-day, and if I don't have them, I'm really going to struggle at life. Second category is social capital. It is exactly what it is. What's my social network? What's my social circle? We really kind of tie that closely to two particular things: close family ties, including significant others. And a significant other can be an actual, it could be a spouse, but it could also be a live-in partner or somebody that we've just been with for a long time, however you want to define that. And then very close friends. Social capital. But there is a third that we've included, and that's where we put access to healthcare. And the reason why we have access to healthcare under social
Yeah, that's a
capital
great question. That's what I was wondering.
is because when we started talking to experts, and we were asking about this, where does healthcare fit? They said, well, let's think about it, the relationship of healthcare. The world wants us to have a relationship with a healthcare brand, but that's not it. You have a relationship with a doctor. How far back does that go? Hundreds of years. There are three relationships that are most important to the human life, at least they have been for the longest time. My spouse, my priest, rabbi, spiritual guider,
Sure.
and my doctor. That's social capital. Third category is cultural capital. Now we're getting into the esoteric, the metaphysical. Who am I? What are my beliefs? What are my values? Do I have a spiritual life? Does that matter? What's my cultural connection to the community in which I live? Do I have a sense of belonging where I live? So, it's the very old school way of thinking of what are the norms and mores of this place that I'm at? Do I fit? Do I don't fit? And there's 22 indicators in the Recovery Capital Index or Resilience Capital Index. We broke them down to those 22 categories. We have three different domains, and every single one of them, we attach a value to. It's a score. And so now all of a sudden you've got a series of numbers scoring across all those areas. And not only is it defined, but it's quantified.
And so, I mean, I love that, and I think that that makes perfect sense. How did you develop the measure? Like, how did you? And I know you have different sizes of measures, and with some with more questions and less questions. And can you talk a little bit about that, the development of it, but also the two that you have, the resiliency and the recovery capital?
So where we started, again, I was operating in a peer coaching environment. We had 150, 200 people a month coming into the facility, and we just need to figure out the question I was posed with was, how do you measure recovery?
Yeah,
You know,
that's
I,
when I first met you, actually. You were working up in North Dakota.
yeah, in North and South Dakota, yeah. And, that question is, you know, harder than we think. It's still difficult, right? How do you measure recovery? The measure that most of us go by is the number of days that we've been sober or haven't used a drug. That's what I thought it was in 2012. But when you sit and think about it and you look at the concept of recovery capital and you talk to social scientists like Dr. Jeffrey Sachs and a few other people in the space that do this, they'll tell you that social science has been measuring the subjective for a long time. So here are the methods for doing that. There's a lot of different ways to create questionnaires and surveys. And so we worked with an NIH fellow at Baylor University, Dr. Sarah Dolan. And Dr. Dolan helped us say, she said, look, you have your concept, you have some general areas that you think are important to measure. Let's cut really long. And so we came up with 121 questions, statements, true, false, whatever. A lot of them from already validated sources, but there was no structure, no consistency. And we just started testing it with our clients. We asked them, would you mind, where we want to create a better measure for this process? Will you help us? And most of them said, yeah, sure. I'm here willing to do anything for my life. So that was a great advantage that we had. And so the scientific process just kind of took over. We tested a bunch of questions, got feedback, reviewed it, revised it. Skip ahead 3 years. We ended up down to 68 items that were all statements that you ranked from strongly agree to strongly disagree. We flipped some of them in terms of their value orientation. So some of them were negatively worded versus positively worded. And that's just a evaluation methodology. And then we asked around about scoring. A lot of the scoring measures that exist in mental health and substance use are all over the place. Some of them are 28-point scales and 52. And the human brain doesn't know how to manage that. They know how to manage 1 to 5, 1 to 10, 1 to 100. So that was a no-brainer. So it scores from 1 to 100. Every item, every indicator, which has multiple questions, every subcategory and then domain can be scored up to 100. And then there's a score of 100. And so that's how we came up with it. It took about 4 or 5 years to get there. And then you bring in some biostatisticians who know how to statistically look at the questionnaire and say, does this measure what you say it measures? We say it measures the improved change or the negative change in a person's quote unquote recovery. And so we defined that, and the statisticians came back and said, based upon these factors, yes, it says it does exactly as you say. And so we published that, like you're supposed to do, in a peer-reviewed medical journal. And then the evaluate, you know, then the, you know, changing it to a resilience versus recovery was just a matter of modifying the questions so that they were more relatable to a family member or somebody not associated with substance use or mental health. But it's still measuring the same thing, right?
Yeah, and I appreciate that description because I really wanted the listener to understand that this isn't just something you created in a, it all makes sense, but a very rigorous scientific research-based, evidence-based scholarly process. So that it's why I love the work that you do. It means something. It tells us something.
Yeah, I mean, I appreciate that. And I used to be really annoyed because I'm not a scientist. My background is radio broadcasting and I got a law degree and wanted to be an architect. I got into this work because, it was necessary, like a lot of us. But, you probably know the phrase research versus me search. This became me search. You want to know the reason why. Why am I, or is anybody, moved to act a certain way? And there are a lot of forces on that. And so I got annoyed sitting in rooms with a lot of actual scientists saying, this is the process, and you got to go through it like all the rest of us. And we're not researchers. We wanted to get that done as fast as we could, but it again took 5, 6 years. But now we're applied scientists. We take that research, we take that data, we take the work that you do and the books that you write, and we apply it in the best, most ethical, consistent to the science and the research way so that others can benefit.
I was just thinking, I would like to, I appreciate that answer. It was an awesome answer. How do we make this whole thing a little more like for each of the three areas, personal capital, social capital, cultural capital, for families to begin to look at their own kind of their own variability. Like how do you understand that vulnerability and how do you counsel, and I know you guys don't do a lot of work with clients, but how would you help families begin to recognize like some really simple things that they can do to improve each of those? And that, and again, when something comes down, there's some subtle things you can do to bring it back up. And like, if you could speak to each of the three areas about just some things that they can do to improve their numbers, not just their love, not just focusing on their loved ones' numbers, but on their own numbers.
Yeah. So let's make it practical. And I do want to say this too. We'll make sure that everybody who watches this, and you can share it however you share this, we'll give everybody a prompt, a keyword that they can text, and they can take the Recovery Capital Index themselves
Oh,
or the
awesome.
RCI themselves. So that way, what I'm about to describe, everybody will have a chance to actually do it, get their own score, and see actually for them how it works.
Awesome.
So, like anything, we have to start somewhere. So we sit down for the first time and we do what I like to describe is you're doing an inventory of your life. So you've never seen this before, but we're going to take 5 to 10 minutes, and typically it takes about 5 minutes, and we're going to go through these 68 items. You're going to do it quiet to yourself and we're going to get done. And then we're going to have a scorecard. Everything's going to have a number assigned to it. Lower the number, more work we got to do. The higher the number, let's just make sure that's what is what it is. Okay. Let's say I'm a family member and I've been dealing with my kid for a decade and I've changed my life in such a way to accommodate their illness. Am I pretty true about that being? Yeah. So I've lost my purpose. My purpose in life has, we all have our purpose to care for our loved ones.
Sure.
That's an innate, natural purpose. But we also find other things in life that are our purpose. But I lost that. I want to be an accountant. Well, I can't be an accountant, so I got two part-time jobs that allow me to care for my son. I want to get back to my purpose, dealing with numbers. So purpose is a question, a set of questions, and we see where that's at. And so I'd see that score and it would say, Sally is low on purpose. And we can just use the motivational interviewing process, you know that well, and work with the person and just let them guide them through thinking about what happened along the way. And how do they start to solutionize getting back to their purpose? Let them realize the next series of steps. And it will be a process. It won't be just, I'd like to go become a doctor because that's what I've always wanted to be, but I've got this disturbance over here. That's a pretty big, lofty goal. Going from, I used to be this, I had to change to do this, but I'd like to get back to that. Well, we'll see that difference in the scoring. That's just one example. But we could take that 22 different ways.
Speak, if you would, to the social capital. I think that is one of the areas that so many families kind of struggle with. They've lost friends along the way. They've isolated because of the need to focus on their issues. They're not necessarily very comfortable in Al-Anon or at least initially craft or whatever they're going to. So can you speak a little bit to how some things they can do to sort of improve that social piece?
Yeah, and really important. I'm glad that you mentioned, the support mechanisms, support groups, and those things. Those are really wonderful for helping us navigate through healing. They're not necessarily social capital. They can be a place where we find comfort and friendship and a lot of those things. But for most of the world, we find our connection generally out in the world. So, the friends that we met in high school, the friends that we met in college, the friends that we meet at work, maybe in our church. So, your question is really important. It is, how do I reinstate myself into that? And there are a lot of different evidence-based practices around how to learn how to be a conversationalist, for instance. And one of the ways to that we did this when when I was back in the coaching practice is people just need to get comfortable talking to people again. And where's the best place to do that in the shortest amount of time? The checkout line at the grocery store. So we give people an outline. You've got 3 and a half, 4, 5 minutes max. And you've got a 16-year-old who doesn't know how to talk anyway. This is a heavy lift. So it's harder for them than it is you. So let's just talk about how you can at least engage this 16 or 20-year-old who's just, checking your food out. Can you start a conversation and build a little bit of an emotional connection with this person? See how that feels. It's not threatening. It's not going to destroy your life. It's going to be done in 5 minutes. So we think about those sorts of things. That's one example. The other that I would say is, and we place a lot of this burden on the person with the addiction. We tell them if, especially if it's a 12-step process, you need to go back and find all the thousands of people that you harmed and, do your amends. Okay. we should do that generally in life. Well, I as a family member should probably think about doing some of that too. If I did isolate and I did drop the ball and I left some things behind, find one of those places and just pick up the phone and say, hey, I'd like to share something. Let me talk. When I'm done, you can react, but I just have to say a few things. And you've coached families on how to have those conversations. That's the place to start. Find a really easy, non-threatening opportunity to just let people know what's going on. I guarantee you, in my experience, maybe 0.5 of people have a negative reaction to what you are experiencing and going through. That simple level of vulnerability.
Mm-hmm.
People will get it. And if they're your friends, they're your friends. If they're your family, they're going to step up. If it's a rando on the street, they're who knows? That's a crapshoot. But most people are going to be like, I'm so sorry. I knew something was up, but didn't know how to handle it. Are you okay? That's going to be the reaction. But you still have to do the thing.
You know, David, I think about like neuroplasticity and how Hebb's law, the neurons that fire together wire together, and that we've, families have wired their brain to respond to things a certain way, the new normal that they create. And what you're really saying is it's time to let some new neurons fire and wire together. And when I think about that, it can't be a one-time deal. It has to be a consistent process where they're continuing to build a new neural network where social engagement is more comfortable, is more satisfying, if you will.
Yeah, one thing I just want to say to that is, and here's the caution to that. We live in an environment that overshares. We live in a world
Right.
that overshares. So I'm not saying go become the sober mom on Instagram. No. In fact, don't do that unless you're really called to do something like that. People don't really like it generally when you just walk up to them and go, hi, my name is David, and I'm 85 days sober, and I'd like to tell you about my journey of recovery. No, people hate that. They really don't like it. But if in the right context of saying, hey, by the way, this is the what happened, that's different. So there are we do have to understand what the new ground rules are to what you just said, and that is, I have to do this a lot. That's why I like the grocery store. Because we need food.
Well, that's what that made me think when you were talking about it. It was what a great place to fire and wire,
Got to go once a week at least, so I can try it on a couple dozen people. And that teenager is not going to know you from Adam from last week. They forgot about you the instant you walked by. So you get to do it all over again. It's Groundhog Day.
The other thing I was thinking is so much of what our program teaches families is to understand kind of family system organization and the rules and the roles and the rituals and routines. And when I think about the cultural assessment, ritual comes into my mind, and that idea of there's so much research on the importance of ritual of, and so many families, because of the addiction, stop celebrating certain things, and that has implications. What are your thoughts on helping families to kind of rekindle, kind of in the big picture, culture in their family, when in the past they may have minimized that?
Yeah, especially because again, I come from the Dakotas where when we talk about culture, drinking is just, and you're lived in Colorado, it's that's culture, right? Craft beer is like Denver. North Dakota, it's drinking Friday night after the football game and just like going for the weekend. Well, so celebration's really tough because we ruined all of our celebration moments because everybody was drunk half the time. Well, how do we flip that script? The place I like to go to is a new ritual is Sunday dinner. Seems old-fashioned, but get everybody around the table. Somebody makes dinner. It doesn't have to be mom, but somebody makes dinner on a Sunday. Put a little work and effort into it. You don't order out. You sit at the table, and as uncomfortable as it will be, you talk. You put the phone away. And you have a conversation, and then you do it again, and then you do it again. We used to train family members to use that Sunday dinner as the time to bring that loved one they care about back to the home, even though they're still mired in their addiction. And what would happen is the person would be like, I'm not doing this. Well, we're going to be here. If you want to eat, we've got food for you. Come back. What that usually turned into a fight before, always. But we had some training materials on how to communicate through conflict. And basically, you ignore the person that's expecting the fight, and everybody else is having jovial, nice conversation. And the person sitting over there going, why am I being left out? Why aren't we arguing? And so I think if you can just get back to that space that's easily controllable, which is a dinner table, that's a good place to start for a new ritual. And then birthdays will happen, and then holidays and all this stuff will take a life of their own, but at least you have that dinner time.
I think that's a great idea. And that is something that allows the healing process of taking the identified client out of that identified client role and back into as a family member. And I think that's my struggle with traditional addiction treatment. And these days I find myself getting more and more frustrated. This is the second podcast in a row I've talked about this, but that idea that we tell families that their job is to support the loved one's recovery. Like that's your role. So you need to come to a family program for that, as opposed to, which I think is a hierarchical situation where we don't have a problem, so we're going to support you because you have a problem. And from a systems theory perspective, that's a non-starter to me. But the second part is we all have stuff. And so we're all the identified patient, or none of us are the identified patient, and we're all just a family, just doing the best we can do.
Yeah, here's a dinner I've taken part of before, and we sort of flipped the script on something known as a Thomas Jefferson dinner, where everybody comes together and there's a particular topic and you got to talk about it. So do some work with a foundation in Minnesota called the Bush Foundation, and somebody brought this to one of our retreats, and it was the "How can I serve you" dinner. And so you would sit around the table and you start at somebody, and then you turn to your left and say, "How can I serve you today and tomorrow? How can I be of service to you?" And the person would think, and then they'd have to say, "Well, I could use help with this." And then you go around, and everybody now has given themselves up to somebody else in service, big or small, within reason, right?
Awesome.
It's very challenging. But also, it's a giving. And that's hard for people that are struggling in their own addiction or their own process of change with people that they have resentments against. But you can play with the seating chart a little bit if you want to, or you just randomly have people sit down. But how can I be of service to you in these next 24 hours?
That's awesome. I've never heard of that, but that sounds like a pretty interesting process.
It's uncomfortable, but it has some effect.
Yeah. I want to be conscious of your time, and I thank you so much for being part of this. And so how can someone access Commonly Well? Like, how can they access that code, or if they have questions or would like to find out how to get the measures and begin a process of healing with that method, which I support 100%.
Yeah.
Tell them how to get a hold of you.
Yeah, our website is commonlywell.com. My email is david@commonlywell.com. And you can just email me directly and I will email the code back. I'll give that code to you and the phone number, and we can share, you can share that out as well. Yeah, and email is the best way. If you're inclined, I spend a lot of time on LinkedIn if you're in that professional network. That's a easily approachable space. Just search my name on LinkedIn. But no, I really appreciate this. And Dr. Barnes, I love what you do because you are trying to move people to think a little bit differently than the status quo that's in the behavioral health and addiction treatment environment. And it's refreshing. I wish there were 1,000 of you, but I'm glad there's you.
Oh, I appreciate that. Thank you. And please, anyone listening, reach out, take the test, and give yourself a chance to really kind of see some areas for growth. Start a process of healing. So, David, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Likewise, thank you.
Absolutely.